of traffic, I would imagine. Good evening, board members, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the regular meeting of the Lahontan Regional Water Quality Control Board. My name is Pete Pumphrey, and I'm the board chair. I want to thank you for coming to our meeting. I want to express my appreciation for the journey you had to make through the traffic. I think that I've never been to a community before that had continuous road repair as an adopted way of life. They're adding a turn lane to the highway near where I live, and we were pretty outraged because it affects about 150 feet of pavement, and it's going to take 3 weeks. So I can hardly wait to go home and say, just cool your jets. Once again, there's another reason why we're fortunate to live where we live. At this time, I would like to introduce the other members of the regional board. We don't have walk-up music for Eric Sandell from Truckee, Don Jardine from Markleyville, Keith Diaz from Rosamond, Kimberly Cox from Hellendale, and Dr. Amy Horn from Truckee. The executive officer is Patty Kuyumjin. Ms. Kuyumjin, would you please introduce the staff?
I'd be pleased to do so. Good evening, everyone. I'd like to start to my left, and Katrina Fleshman is our board clerk. Liz Barrett is our legal counsel. I'm now going to go out to our audience there. And we have Doug Smith, our assistant executive officer, in the audience. Scott Ferguson, one of our division managers, is out there. Kelly Huck, who you'll be hearing from later today. Mary Fiore Wagoner, Mark Tahos, Ann Holden. We have Ben Lutton, who you'll be hearing from shortly. Dan Sussman from our Tahos office, and all the way from Victorville, Patrice Copeland. I'd also like to thank Brandon St. Pierre, a former employee of ours, now with the State Water Board. Thanks for coming as well. I think I got everyone, yeah.
Thank you. The regional board will be considering many items during this meeting. Please feel free to comment on any item so our decision will be based on all available information. We now webcast our water board meetings. The link can be found on the agenda. If you wish to speak on an agenda item, please fill out the orange speaker card from the back of the room and hand that card to Katrina Fleshman, our board clerk. Please respect the board members, staff presenters, and your fellow citizens. Everyone's views should be heard. A lot of people wish to talk. I may place time limits on presentations. If you have any written materials as part of the agenda item, please hand copies to Katrina Fleshman, and she will distribute them. So that we may have an accurate administrative record, please speak after I call your name and invite you to come up to the lectern. Please communicate your ideas clearly and efficiently. So with that, the first item on the agenda is closed session, which will not take place this evening. It will be sometime tomorrow. Item two is public forum, in which any person may address the water board regarding a matter within the water board's jurisdiction that is not related to an item on this meeting agenda or currently pending before the board. Comments regarding pending or impending adjudicatory matters will not be allowed. Matters pending from the time the Water Board issues an initial pleading in an evidentiary proceeding or from the time an application for a decision is filed that will require an evidentiary hearing, whichever is earlier. For enforcement action, this means that comments related to enforcement actions during public forums are not allowed from the time a draft order is issued. Similarly, the public may not provide comments during public forum relating to a waste discharge requirement after the Water Board receives a report of waste discharge, which begins the permitting process. Comments regarding matters that are under development for future meetings are not within the Water Board's regulatory authority will be prohibited. Comments will generally be limited to 5 minutes. Any person wishing to make a longer presentation should request an extension from the executive officer at least 15 days prior to the meeting. Well, I think that may have taken longer than the item. I do not have an orange card for this item. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to address the board during this public forum agenda item? All that conversation in vain. Item 3, minutes from the regular meeting of July 10, 2019, held in Bishop, California.
I'll make a motion we approve the minutes. Second.
It's been moved and seconded. Mr. Diaz?
Yes.
Ms. Cox?
Aye.
Mr. Sandel?
Aye.
Mr. Jardine?
Aye.
Dr. Horn?
I will abstain because I don't feel comfortable approving minutes for a meeting I could not attend and of which I have no personal knowledge.
And I vote aye. Excuse me. Item 4 is reports by Water Board Chair and Board members. Mr. Diaz?
No report, thank you.
Ms. Cox?
No report.
Mr. Jardine?
Just a quick report. Lahan's staff came down to the Washoe Tribe and did a presentation on the Vision Project, the West Fork of the Carson. They did an extraordinary job reaching out to our community. And it deeply appreciated the comments after the meeting that I received. They're very appreciative and very transparent. Just thank you, guys.
Thank you. Mr. Sandel?
No report, thank you.
Dr. Horn?
No report.
I just have a couple of quick things. A reminder that WQCC is going to be held on the 29th and 30th of October in Sacramento. The agenda should be on its way to you shortly, but there are three basic points of emphasis on the agenda. One is the executive order and portfolio process. The second is discussion of sustainable groundwater. And the third relates to the Safe and Affordable Drinking Water Act and the follow-up to SB 200, which was passed this year. They're talking about the possibility of fixing the dates for WQCC in the future so that you will know or we will all know that it's the third Tuesday and Wednesday of October or whatever. But I think that will be discussed at the meeting in October. A couple of just quick things that were talked about in terms of SB 200, which was is the legislation that appropriated funds for the implementation of the Clean and Affordable Drinking Water Act, they would like to discuss the possibility of doing listening sessions within the regions regarding the manner in which those funds are going to be worked with and potentially allocated. There's also an indication that there's going to be follow-up, and I'm sure that we'll get to this in greater depth tomorrow in the actual agenda item regarding the portfolio, but there will be follow-up to the comments to the initial portfolio listening period, which are due by September 30th, that will roll back to the people, or the regions at least, making comments sometime after they're received. I'm guessing that's going to be sometime late October. No one seems to know how that's actually going to work or what the mechanism for that is going to be. My feeling is that there's a tremendous number of comments that have been generated. I went to two sessions in Bishop, and I think the number was over 50. It was a very robust conversation. This is a segue. There was also a number of recommendations and comments from the Water Summit, which was held last Thursday and Friday in Kings Beach. That was, I think, a successful program, project. Patty Kuyumjin and Doug Smith from Lahontan both gave excellent presentations as a part of that summit. The summit seemed to concentrate basically on headwaters issues, particularly forest management, and particularly inside of that, everyone's concern over fire issues. There were a number of really, really interesting presentations. especially the ones that were devoted to tools, GIS mapping. That was a really interesting presentation on aerial snow monitoring. There were some really scary presentations showing fire mapping and the rates and way that fires, these gigantic fires that we've had over the past several years, move, how they act. And the PowerPoints that accompany those presentations are going to be on the Sierra Water Work Group website so that you can get a chance to take a look at those. There was some action taken in the sense that the overarching recommendation portfolio-wise from the Water Summit was to request that as a part of creating the water portfolio, that proportionate consideration and funding and support be given to the Sierra in terms of its role as the waters of origin for a high percentage of the water in the state of California, rather than focusing all the attention and funding on downstream uses and downstream projects that perhaps the state would like to acknowledge the role that the Sierra and Sierra Headwaters play in the overall California water system. Those recommendations will also be on the Sierra Water Work Group website, I would guess sometime in the next couple of weeks. Hopefully there's going to be another summit next year to follow up on that. It was really a good event this year, and it has been really during the 8 years that it's been held. So I will let you know when we have dates, hopefully, for that event for next year. So that's all I have. Item 5 is the Executive Officer's Report.
Board members and those in the audience, I guess I got to get just a smidge closer here. I'm going to give you updates this evening on the August and September EOR reports that are in your packets. Our next board meeting, as a reminder, will be in Barstow on November 20th and 21st. Let me start out by congratulating our board members, Dr. Amy Horn and Kimberly Cox, on their recent Senate confirmation, and thank you for your service to the board. We all know it's a labor of love, so thank you. Please note the pink sheet in your packet has an additional article, which you'll hear more about later, and our proposed 2020 board schedule. I'll be looking for your thoughts regarding this new calendar earlier this year because of scheduling complexities. We have webcasting now, so we need to kind of lock that in sooner, and venues are harder and harder to get. Katrina Fleshman and I will follow up with you later on your thoughts on the schedule. As I said, Kelly Huck will be giving you a demonstration later on the article that's in your pink sheet. And that is a follow-up, as a reminder, from when we came to the board previously on our Swamp Core regulatory review over the summer. We had said we're not quite ready to show you this, but now we are. So stay tuned for that at the end of my report. Another reminder, the State Board's tour of Leviathan Mine and some choice spots in Tahoe, assuming we get there through the traffic, will be Friday morning at 8:30. We're meeting at the Lahontan offices. There is an itinerary in the back of the room if you're curious or would like to go. So let me start with my report. And let me start with one of our regular updates on our triennial review. This you can find on Bait Stamps 5-14. Staff have provided a very good report there of where we are on our triennial review. I have some good news to report. Two projects are approved by the board. One is the Lake Tahoe Pier Construction Basin Plan Amendment that was approved by our board and then approved by the State Water Board in June and now is at US EPA. So we're waiting to hear back from them.
Patty, I just want to mention that that item is going to OAL.
Oh, it went. Oh, even better news. It's on its way to OAL.
Yeah, not EPA.
The Mojave River surface water beneficial uses is set to go before the State Board on October 1st. It's right around the corner. I'm hopeful it'll be on the uncontested item. As you know, we have limited basin plan staff who are now working on the integrated report. That'll be before you in November. As soon as that project is completed, staff will shift to our highest priority project, and that is to evaluate the bacteria water quality objectives. They've already begun some work on this project and developed a strategy to begin the beginning stages of implementing that project. We will report back to you with more details on this project as it goes through, since it is a high priority project for the board and certainly for stakeholders. The climate change adaptation and mitigation strategy will be for you in November, and depending on the decisions you make on that, it could result in additional basin plan amendments when the action plan is before you next spring. The source water protection and riparian protection policies are also linked to the climate change strategy. All these projects are going to be influenced by administration decisions made later this year to implement the governor's executive order. There's a lot of movement in Sacramento in legislation on this order, so that may shift priorities, provide resources yet to be seen. Staff have also begun work on other projects, such as the tribal beneficial uses. We're in the beginning stages of gathering information and talking to other regional boards and state board. The Truckee River sediment objective, we're engaging with stakeholders and gathering some data and considering maybe combining it with the TMDL update. Water quality objectives for the Mojave groundwater are on hold at the moment due to staffing limitations. I'm now going to shift to another issue, and that's the Joint Powers Authority for the City of Bishop and Eastern Sierra Community Service District. There are actually two articles on that issue, one in the month of August and one in the month of September, on bait stamp 5-17 and 5-45. I wanted to call this out because I really want to recognize the great collaborative and leadership efforts of our Victorville office. You'll see a very nice letter in your packet there from the parties, including LADWP. After decades of separate efforts, these two agencies are finally joining forces as something we've hoped and dreamed of for years. I remember Mike Plasiak starting this effort way back when. To form a JPA to solve their wastewater and groundwater problems. LADWP also stepped up and provided the much-needed land to sell to the JPA so they could reuse their treated wastewater. So, you know, we talk about the importance of collaboration, that it yields results, and this is an example of that. So I just wanted to point out our staff's great work. Now I'm going to move to the Ridgecrest earthquake. In July, I gave you an update on what had happened, and I promised I'd come back in my executive officer's report with lots of pictures. So that starts on bait stamp 5-18. And as you can see, we put a lot of pictures in there because it really tells the story. So as you know, there were two earthquakes, the July 4th, the 6.4, and the more intense 7.1 the next evening, 11 times stronger. The governor issued the emergency order, and our staff rallied at that time to go out and look at all the facilities over that weekend. And our staff have been working with the local representatives and these dischargers ever since. For facilities regulated by staff, I'm just going to highlight a few. The hardest hit is probably China Lake Navy Weapons Station. Incidental reports of up to $5 billion in damage. It's still closed. They're still assessing the damage, and we're still awaiting a formal report from China Lake on that. But we are working with Kern County and Cowher Cycle and helping them to allow the debris from that earthquake to go to the Ridgecrest landfill. As to be expected with all emergencies, the waste has to be separated with the normal waste management materials going to the landfill and the more hazardous waste being appropriately disposed at other facilities. The Searles Valley Minerals Facility was also heavily damaged, and there's some nice pictures in there of that. They're still working on repairs, and they're still closed. The Trona Wastewater Disposal has some broken pipes, and we also are coordinating with them. And it was nice to see a lot of other wastewater facilities rally to help. I know that some of the Mojave area folks rallied to come up and help out Trona. Our Division of Drinking Water is also working because there's an awful lot of broken drinking water pipes that they're... As I'm near the bottom of our region, let me try to go to the very top of our region in the Lassen County and talk about our grazing update. This starts on bait stamp 5-38. So let me start with Eagle Lake. In May, I issued 8 investigative orders to 3 private ranchers, the U.S. Forest Service, BLM, and 3 private landowners with the plans due July 22nd. So 4 of the 8 have complied. 3 of them what I would call non-grazers. These are people where the cattle were on their land, but they did not wish the cattle to be on their land. And so they confirmed that for us, and that's Chico State, the Spalding Track folks, and Lassen County. 1 private rancher, the McClellan Ranch, has also completed their plans. The remaining 4 has submitted partial plans, and we're working collaboratively with them to help finish those remaining plans. I attended a meeting in Sacramento recently. Pete Pumphrey participated, as board member Sean McGuire, for a listening session for many of the associations who had written us a letter expressing concern about the Eagle Lake investigative order as well as the federal non-point source permit. When I mention associations, I mean the Cattlemen's Farm Bureau and the Sheep Growers Association. A number of Eagle Lake ranchers were present there, UC Davis and other folks also attended that meeting. So we were there to listen to their concerns. I think overall it was a good meeting. I think we came to a better understanding of each other's roles and responsibilities. And I made a commitment to collaborate with them going forward and open lines of communication. And true to my word, our staff have already been going up to Eagle Lake to meet with the ranchers, to work with them and going forward. So I think that was a good outcome. More meetings to happen. The Eagle Lake Guardians have also requested a public meeting up in there. And at the right time, we'll be having a public meeting. And we're going to use the facilitation services of our old friend Gita Kapai and her unit to help facilitate when that time comes. Since I mentioned the federal non-point source permit, let me talk about that. That's the permit, as you recall, that we're doing with the Central Valley Regional Board. We're working internally to recraft the permit right now, the 2 regional boards, to be modeled after our performance-based permitting that we do in our region. And I give you the Tahoe TMDL and the timber waivers as examples of how we've done performance-based permitting in our region. And again, just to remind Patrick, the EO from Region 5 was attending also this meeting that I just referenced with the associations. And I also want to mention, which is in your packet in the pink sheet, is a proposed schedule for next year. What Patrick and I have been informally discussing is a possible joint listening session in the spring of next year with the 2 boards, potentially with a subset of the board members from each region sitting to have a listening session about the framework of what this permit might look like, allow stakeholders to participate and comment. I don't have a lot of details on it yet, but that's what we're considering for next year. In our article on grazing, you'll see updates on Bridgeport and our field tour out there. You'll also have an update on our discussions with LADWP in that article and some pictures. Well, since we're on green grazing, let me move to another green issue, and that's our standing report on cannabis. That's on bait stamp 5-42. And so far, we have 82 indoor grows and 15 outdoor grows in our region. And they are kind of bunched up in 2 areas, quite a bit of them, 46 in Adelanto and 35 in California City. That's quite a lot in those 2 locales. Our outreach is going well and very successful. In fact, the administration is doing sort of road trips, if you will, to different communities about the cannabis laws involving all the state agencies. There's so many state agencies involved in the permitting and regulation. The good news to report is the state and regional boards are getting shout-outs about our great outreach and our collaboration in helping growers comply with those complex requirements. So that's nice. And actually today in our offices, many of the regions and state board folks were gathered in terms to discuss cannabis enforcement. So, I also want to mention, I think I alluded to it earlier, that not as many people are enrolling as we originally thought they would. And we're still working on that. But what that means, we have a shortfall of quite a few million dollars. And that'll be kind of interesting. There are no plans for any layoffs or anything like that, and there are no plans for fee increases. So as everything, we're going to have to be clever by a margin and make do with what we have. In fact, Doug and I will be traveling down to Sacramento next week to try to figure this all out with the other regions. So stay tuned. Another standing item in your packet is the City of Barstow nitrate. This is on Bates Stamp 5-43. The city is implementing the new WDR that the board just recently adopted at our July board meeting. And as a reminder, the city also updated their wastewater facility as required by the CDO, so the board also just recently rescinded that CDO. The city tested the 35 private wells for nitrate, and all were below the MCL. However, because the way that our cleanup and abatement order is written, which is how some of our many orders are, is when you start inching towards the 10, which the measuring point is 5, you have to provide bottled water. So 10 households get bottled water. The next step will be revisiting the CAO at some point down the line, but not sure when that's going to happen yet. Another standing item in your packet is on the Barstow perchlorate plume. You can find that article on 5-46. This is the area where we received a grant, I think it's $2.6 million in change from the State Water Board to do an investigation. Well, when you investigate, sometimes you find. So we did site characterization this summer to delineate the soil and the groundwater impacts, and we found a couple of hot spots you'll see in the article with perchlorate concentrations pretty darn high, 57,000 to 72,000 in the soil, and groundwater samples as high as over 2,000 milligrams per liter. A reminder, the MCL is 6. There's a map in there, and if you look really hard and squint, you'll see purple dots inside green boxes, and that's where a lot of the high numbers are. You know, that's why these investigations are so important and why the money that the State Water Board gives us is so important. So we can do these kind of investigations, so we can solve some of our water quality problems. So I thank the State Water Board. Another standing item I want to update on is the LACSD District 20 Palmdale cleanup. You may find that on Bates Stamp 5-53. The district continues to delineate the nitrate plume in the north near, this is kind of near Air Force Plant 42. There's actually a little map in there, if you could find it. More test results are expected this fall and winter to determine the sources of the nitrate, to kind of get a better bead on if it's coming from sewage or ag or other places. More drinking water supply wells are being tested in the Lancaster area. But where they're all below the 10 MCL. More monitorings, we're going to be going into the north. I'm happy to report that the extraction system that's been in place since 2007 is working well. The total mass of nitrate has decreased. There's a nice little chart in there kind of showing by each year how it's being reduced. Overall, the plume is shrinking, and some monitoring wells are no longer needed. The district will re-examine the extraction system once more test results are in. These are the ones I refer to this fall and winter. And this is kind of what we look for in our groundwater cleanups, that we're seeing the mass reduce, the plume shrinking. So it's good news. However, we are keeping a sharp eye on the north. Because that's where we've had some issues in the past, where some of the plume shape has changed a little bit. And the areas that we're keeping an eagle eye on, just so you know, let me find the, are to the north near the domestic wells, the drinking water supply wells for Northrop Grumman, and the Air Force Plant 42, which is kind of close to the plume. And nearby Palmdale drinking water well field, there's a rather big well field down below that has that's important to keep an eye on. So let me shift to new issues that are not in the report. Sino-Hab outbreaks. We've had quite a few this year. This has been a rather busy year for staff, mostly Mary. 17 affected surface waters throughout our region. That's a quite a bit of that's a big increase over last year. The elevations range from 2,700 feet from Horseshoe Lake all the way up to over 9,000 feet at Star Lake. The lakes vary, some in areas with disturbed urban watershed, other ones in the High Sierras. So it's varied. We had three reported dog deaths that we investigated. There was concerns of that, and the water testing on all three came back negative. We're still waiting for a necropsy result on one dog death. So for our region to date, we have had 2 danger levels, 2 warning, 10 caution, and 3 still pending that we need to get results back on. So it's been a robust year for Sino-Hab. And in case you wonder, all the regions are struggling. Let me move to an explosive issue. And a personal one for many, for me, and I know certainly our Victorville staff. And this is live munitions at George Air Force Base. Our DOD staff have been very concerned about buried live munitions located on an unfenced property south and east of the Bureau of Prisons site, near housing developments. Our staff wrote a letter in early September to the Air Force expressing our significant concerns regarding the site and requesting that the Air Force take appropriate measures to protect the public safety and please put up a fence and please put proper signage to protect. There's a lot of activity with kids and others riding up and down the hills on their motorcycles and bicycles. If you look at Google Earth, you could see all that action on top of that area. It was upsetting for our staff, I know. We met some original resistance to our request, but I think we're having a good path forward with toxics and the Air Force to move forward to put in a fence. But we remain concerned. And in case you wondered, it's not within our statutory authority to order a fence. We can do investigations, we can do a characterization, as for says, but we can't order them to put up a fence. However, toxics can and US EPA can. So that's why we wrote a letter. If I could have taken action, I would have. Another explosive issue, but a different one. The South Tahoe fuel truck crash that happened recently as you were heading in Highway 50 into Tahoe. On September 17th, around noon, a fuel tanker crashed on the bridge over Upper Truckee River near Highway 50 and Elks Club Road. It's on the way into Tahoe. The highway was closed for some time. The truck caught fire and was totally destroyed. Its contents were gasoline and petroleum, some diesel. Sadly, there was a fatality. The truck had over 7,000 gallons of fuel, and we think a healthy amount of it burned. However, some of it did indeed make it to the creek and the embankments and the storm inlet and the wetland area. And we think shallow groundwater might be affected. The Department of Fish and Wildlife tends to take the lead on oil spill emergencies, whether it's on the coast or inland. So they are now the incident command. And so we are working with them on cleanup, sampling, analysis, technical support, cleanup levels. So our staff have been very involved in that. Much of the contaminated soil, good news, has been removed. They were in there pretty fast trying to remove the contaminated soil. But as with fuel fires, they use flame retardants that contain PFOAs. So staff are going to be doing some additional testing on the PFOAs. This is the end of my report, so I thought it might be best if you had any questions before I ask Kelly Huck to please come up to show you the data visualization tool. Do you have any questions on some of the information I covered, board members?
Any questions, Mr. Sandell?
No questions.
Mr. Jardine?
No questions.
Dr. Horn?
No questions.
Mr. Dias?
No questions, thank you.
Ms. Cox?
Thank you. Yes, Chair. I did have a couple of questions. Patty, when you were talking on Bait Stamp 542 and 543 about the cannabis and how there are fewer people registering or fewer entities registering than what was anticipated, is it because they're still growing and doing it illegally, or is there not as many growers as what was anticipated? Is there any idea as to why the reduced number of permits?
I would say it's a little mixture of both. But part of the problem, there's a lot more illegal grows, and it's harder with the resources to find all of those. So we've been focusing on getting legal grows enrolled. And so there are less of those, as well as when we started this journey and this program, it was before a lot of counties and cities made decisions whether they would or wouldn't allow it into their communities. And more communities, I think, than were anticipated when they first started this legislation, said no thank you to cannabis facilities. So I think it's all three of those coming together as to why there are less than expected.
Thank you. Second question I had, how were the munitions discovered near the former George Air Force Base?
Staff were concerned about it. It became more aware in terms of some technical reports they received, and so they were very concerned that a partial area had been cleaned up and had been stopped because of running out of money. And so staff actually for months have been asking and cajoling and encouraging to do something to the point where they weren't getting any response from some of our sister agencies or the Air Force. So we talked internally and decided then we at least need to write, we have to do something. If we can't order it, and God knows I tried to look for ways to do that, then at least we should write a letter to tell them how important this is. And that got noticed.
My recollection, having been in the area for a few decades now, that was the location that used to have the earthen bunkers with the door in the front, and they'd bury this stuff or store it underground. Is that the same
area? I think so. I know Patrice could tell me a little bit more, but I know they also shot it there. That was a practice range.
Okay.
But, you know, back in the day, people used to dump things all kinds of places in the desert, so...
Well, I hope that gets addressed expeditiously. Thank you.
I hope so, too. It really worries me.
I have no questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you. So, Kelly?
Good evening. Let my demonstration. My name is Kelly Huck, and I work in the Planning and Assessment Unit as an environmental scientist. I am the Surface Water Ambient Monitoring Program, also known as SWAMP Coordinator for our region. I'm here tonight as a follow-up from our SWAMP Core Programmatic Review that was presented by Dan Sussman in July in the Bishop Board meeting. In that review, we determined many recommendations for our program moving forward, one of which is to maximize our data access using analytical tools and new technology to report on trends and other observations. One way we're hoping to conquer this task is to use data visualizations. This is a visual representation of data using statistical graphics, plots, information graphics, and other tools. Therefore, making complex data more accessible, understandable, and most importantly, more usable for the public. There are several platforms available to do these sorts of visualizations. Some include Tableau, Microsoft Power BI, and ArcGIS. Currently, State Board and other regions are already using these platforms, and I would like to walk you through a couple examples before I get to our data visualization. So my first example is the Bioassessment Regional Snapshot. State Board has used Tableau to display bioassessment data regionally in the context of land use to show that landscapes have an impact on the biology of streams. So this map will display our California Stream Condition Index scores and differentiate between the land uses. The California Stream Condition Index score is a biological scoring tool that helps to translate complex data about benthic macroinvertebrates found living in stream in an overall measurement of stream health. So this map is very user-friendly. It uses colors to determine, see what happens here. Did not mean to click on that. Colors to determine if the stream is likely intact, which is the highest score, all the way down to red, very likely altered, meaning it has a low score and we assume that there's poor stream health. You're able to click on a specific area you're interested in, so I will click on our region. And you can zoom into areas of interest. I'll zoom into the Lake Tahoe area. So as you can see, we have lots of green, luckily, a few red. And this also differentiates the different shapes will show what different land uses, forest, urban, agricultural. So you can really decipher possibly what you're interested in looking at, looking at the land uses. This map also includes water quality data, so you can also look into that further. The next map I'd like to show you is the Central Valley Regional Water Quality Control Board E. coli monitoring results. Region 5 conducts weekly E. coli monitoring at popular recreation areas and public access points on the American River. In close to real time as possible, will post these results online. So the public is able to come on here and determine the most recent bacteria results and see if this is an area that they feel safe recreating in or if they would like to exercise caution. This is, again, easy to decipher color coding, green, meaning all the objectives are met, and then red, the objectives are not met, and then yellow as its objectives are above the objective for the geometric mean. So there you might want to exercise caution. So this is a great example of using data in real time and how applications for human health and safety issues. So I will go ahead and click on our map, which I'm very excited to talk about. It just went live this morning, so it's very new. And we are able to display our swamp data in a way that we hope is user-friendly and accessible. Currently, since it is such a new product, we only have 6 sites right now, but our goal is to get all our swamp sites, starting with all our permanent long-term sites, up first. So you can look at the map and click on areas of interest. So right now it's clicked on the Susan River. We have the Truckee River, West Fort Carson, East Fort Carson, West Walker River, and the East Walker River. With every site, we've included a dialogue to give a background on the area and also a photo. You can scroll down, and we've included a summary table that includes all the analytes that we have sampled for, and this is strictly swamp data. So some of our data sets are 19 years or more of data included in this. For each analyte, we include a count, how many samples we've sampled over the years, a min, a max, medium. I could scroll over. Can't see the bottom. Can't see the bottom bar, but there's also trends are included on this. If you're interested in a very specific analyte, you can click on that one and it will drop down and show you by year what the numbers include. As you scroll down, we have each analyte represented graphically. And on this graph, it includes our objective that we are trying to obtain, and for boron specifically for the Walker River, we are looking at the site-specific objective annual average in our basin plan. This also includes if our trends are increasing, decreasing, or we do not see a trend, and there's also available to download all relevant data that's included in this graphic. So it includes a lot of information. So every analyte that we've displayed will have its own graph and include opportunities to download the data, what objective we're comparing to, and single sample values. Another great tool on here is you can click on these points and you can see when it was sampled and what the result is. For these triangles, it will give you the annual averages, and then for the circles, it's the single sample. So we're really excited about this tool, and what's next for it, as I've already mentioned, is adding in all our additional sites, getting review from other our colleagues to see ways we can improve this product, also to determine if there's a different statistical method that would be more appropriate or powerful for our results, and yeah, adding as much information as possible. So that's all I have to share with you tonight. If you guys have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you very much. Mr. Dias? Ms. Cox?
No questions, just very, very impressive. Thank you for your work.
Oh, and real quick, this was done in close, working closely with State Board Swamp staff, Michelle Tang, who is the computer genius behind all this. So I'd like to really thank her.
Dr. Horn?
No questions. This is very exciting stuff.
Thank you.
Mr. Jardine?
No questions.
Mr. Sandale?
I mastered it. This is really going to be useful. I really only had one comment, no questions, and that is I'm going through these multiple pages, and I see the Susan River is actually only a headline on one of them, and I think all the data is for the Susan River. I think it might be handy to have what the site is on each page. Maybe this is one screen and
yeah, that was
part of it.
That was just specifically for a handout in case the internet wasn't working.
Yeah.
So there's not actually pages on here. It's just you would scroll down. So, but that's a good point. If you plan on printing up pages or doing that, it's a good point.
No, thanks. It's great.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. I don't have any questions. I would just join with everyone else. It's an excellent piece of work.
Thank you so much.
Really,
thank you.
Really appreciate it.
Thanks.
Item 6 is a discussion of irrigated lands regulatory program development. I have one gold card indicating someone wishes to speak on this. If there's anyone else who wishes to address this item, please fill out a card and give them to Ms. Fleshman, so that we can make sure that we call on you and get your comments.
Okay, good evening. Good evening, Board Chair Pumphrey and members of the board. My name is Ben Letton. I'm a division manager here in your South Lake Tahoe office. Welcome to Tahoe. Before I get started, I wanted to say that, Chair Pumphrey, I was identifying with your comment earlier about the traffic because I'm still kind of new to Tahoe. And when I got here, people said, oh, there's six seasons in Tahoe. There's your standard summer, fall, winter, spring. And then there's tourist season and construction season. So I'm familiar with the other four, but still trying to get used to the two new ones. Tonight, I will be presenting agenda item 6 in your board pack and an informational item on the irrigated lands regulatory program development. As an information item, the board will not be asked to take any action at this time. However, I encourage board members to develop questions and comments throughout my presentation so that we can have a productive discussion and that board can provide staff input and direction for future decisions and actions related to irrigated agriculture in the region. Before I begin the presentation, I'd like to recognize several staff members who played a significant role in developing of the materials that I will be presenting, some of which are in the audience this evening. TJ Middlemiss Clark is with our cannabis unit. Kathleen Bendel is with our cannabis unit. Ann Holden is in our non-point source unit. And Dr. Bruce Warden, I don't see him, but he also helped out significantly. They mastermind a lot of the information and data, maps, et cetera, that I'll be sharing tonight. And with a lot of projects in the water board, you know, they really provide a lot of the horsepower. And I'm just delivering the message. So we try to keep the ship steered more or less in the right direction in terms of management. But again, the staff really provide the horsepower and deserve most of the credit. Also in the audience tonight, excuse me, is Brianna St. Pierre, who comes for us from the State Water Board. Some of you may recognize Brianna, as she used to work in our Victorville office before accepting a position at the State Water Boards in Sacramento. Brianna now works as the unit chief at State Board and helps oversee many of the agricultural programs there. She will be available throughout the item to help answer questions related to the Irrigated Lands Regulatory Program development and the program statewide, including the presidential requirements of the East San Joaquin Order or specific details on other regional board programs. Thank you, Brianna, for being here tonight to help support us. I plan on covering quite a bit of ground tonight, as there is quite a story to tell about water quality regulation of agriculture in California. Here's a basic outline of what we'll be covering throughout the presentation. I'd like to start first by talking about the history of irrigated agriculture regulation, followed by a fair amount of detail of the 2018 East San Joaquin Order and its presidential requirements. Then I'll go into a summary of the regional irrigated land program throughout the state of the different 9 water boards. And then I'll talk about more specifically about existing irrigated agriculture in the La Junta region, including total number of irrigated acres, commodity types, irrigation methods, things like that. Then we'll talk more specifically about known surface and groundwater impacts from agriculture in the La Junta region. And then we'll conclude by talking about next steps and some recommended actions moving forward. I anticipate that this presentation will take about 30 to 35 minutes, which should leave us time to for comments and questions from the board and from interested members of the audience. As I alluded to earlier, and as many of you already know, agriculture in California is a significant land use and has been a significant economic driver for the state for a long time. Over the last century, there are many areas of the state that have expanded in terms of agricultural production, and some areas where production has diminished or been eliminated completely. Although not in our region, this photo is of Orange County in the LA Basin from about the 1930s. Obviously, land use has changed significantly there since that time, but other areas of the state in our region have been and continue to be in irrigated agricultural production. As such, irrigation tailwater, return flows, storm water, and discharges to land and groundwater have been occurring from irrigated lands in California for over a century, which in some cases had led to significant water quality contamination, such as extensive nitrate groundwater issues in the Central Valley. In terms of regulation and control of those discharges, the Clean Water Act provided exemptions for irrigated discharges to surface water, largely because those discharges have been considered point sources of pollution. Contrasted with point sources of pollution, the Clean Water Act does not require regulatory control of non-point source pollution. However, adoption of the Porter-Cologne Control Act would actually predates the 1972 Clean Water Act, provided the regional boards with the authority to regulate discharges from both point source and non-point source discharges. Within Porter-Cologne, the regional boards were able to waive such requirements under Water Code Section 13269, where such waiver is not against the public interest. In the 1980s, under the Clean Water Code Section 13269, the regional water quality control boards waived waste discharge requirements for 48 different categories of low-threat discharges, including irrigation return flow and stormwater discharges from ag lands. These waivers exempted these agricultural activities from needing waste discharge requirements. These waivers tended to have very few requirements themselves and did not include monitoring or reporting. In 1999, Senate Bill 390 amended Water Code Section 13269, which I mentioned just a minute ago, requiring regional boards to review and revise existing waivers. Those waivers were not reviewed or revised, would expire in 2003. In 2003, the Central Valley Water Board adopted its first conditional waiver of waste discharge requirements for irrigated agriculture. Sometime after 2003, the Central Valley also initiated a long-term program which resulted in the development of watershed-specific orders. Between 2012 and 2015, Central Valley Water Board began adopting waste discharge requirements that addressed both surface and groundwater discharges, including the East San Joaquin Order. Shortly after adoption of the East San Joaquin Order in January of 2013, three separate petitions were filed with the State Water Board regarding its adoption. February of 2018, the State Water Board adopts the East San Joaquin Order, including its precedential requirements, which I will go into more detail in a few slides. As I stated previously, there were three legal challenges or petitions filed in the Sacramento Superior Court related to several aspects of the East San Joaquin Order. The petitions to the State Water Board initiated a comprehensive review of the East San Joaquin Order. The review resulted in a series of essential requirements such as nitrogen tracking and reporting that are to be incorporated into all existing and newly developed regional board irrigated agricultural permits. The statewide precedential portion of the East San Joaquin Order remain in effect on regional boards until the order or portions are invalidated by court judgment or are stayed by a court or the State Water Board. In reviewing the East San Joaquin Order, the State Water Board focused on two primary questions. First, did the East San Joaquin Order comply with the non-point source policy? And did the East San Joaquin Order comply with the anti-degradation policy? In short, the State Board found that the East San Joaquin Order did not comply with the non-point source policy and as such established precedential requirements to ensure that the order and any new revised orders statewide would consistently comply with the policy. They did, however, find that the East San Joaquin Order generally did comply with the anti-degradation policy. Based on that review and those findings, this presentation focuses on compliance with the non-point source policy, since the precedential requirements address that. Compliance with the anti-degradation policy was upheld and won't be discussed further at this time. As a reminder, per the non-point source policy, non-point source programs must address non-point source pollution in a manner that achieves and maintains water quality objectives and beneficial uses. Non-point source programs must have high likelihood that implementing management practices will attain water quality objectives and beneficial uses will be protected, with enough feedback to determine if the program is meeting its purpose or if actions are required. Revisions to the East San Joaquin Order are intended to provide more assurance that management practices will result in receiving water limits being met with monitoring to verify. Here are the main precedential requirements established in the East San Joaquin Order in more detail. Although generally more prescriptive than previous orders, the requirements still allow the regional boards a fair amount of discretion and flexibility. Irrigation and nitrogen management. This could include field-level nitrogen applied and removed tracking and reporting and development of crop-specific nitrogen removal coefficients. Erosion control planning and implementation could apply where there is a potential to discharge sediment to surface waters or areas that are high, are erosive, or have steep slopes. Management practice reporting. Under this requirement, all growers must report management practice implementation. Water board have discretion over the form and frequency of the submissions. Water quality monitoring and evaluation. Examples here might include annual nitrate sampling for on-farm drinking water wells. Any additional constituents, sampling frequency, are at the water board discretion. Another example could include groundwater monitoring trends, either at individual farms or larger areas with multiple farms. Education and outreach. Here the precedential requirements include general education for all enrollees, additional training for growers, potentially additional training for growers with high nitrogen applied versus removed ratios. In terms of record keeping and third-party coalitions, an element of the presidential requirement there might include coalitions being required to maintain required reports and record for 10 years and have backup of all their data in storage. In this slide, we have listed 8 of the 9 regional boards and a summary of each of their irrigated lands programs. This excludes the Lahontan region, as we are in the beginning stage of development of our own program. As you can see in the table, most started out with waivers and are now trending towards general waste discharge requirements. The Central Valley region is an example of that I discussed earlier in the presentation. The majority of the regions use third-party coalitions. Some provide general orders for individuals. Most regions use a combination of region-wide, watershed-specific, and commodity-specific approaches. Some irrigated land programs implement TMDLs, such as regions 2, 7, and 8. It's worth noting that the Lahontan region does not currently have TMDLs adopted that have irrigated ag as a primary source. Tiered approaches based on water quality risk in relation to farm size are also common with these waivers and waste discharge requirements. As you can see from the table, and again, Region 6 is not present, staff will be evaluating approaches for applicability to the Lahontan region. We will also be consulting with other regions for lessons learned and pros and cons of various approaches. Now we are at a point in the presentation where I'd like to pivot a bit and talk more specifically about irrigated agriculture in our region. In this section of the presentation, I will summarize the types of irrigated agricultural commodities, the approximate total number of acres, and the types of irrigation methods of the most prevalent crop types. First, I'd like to touch briefly on existing regulation of irrigated agriculture in the region. The Bridgeport Grazing Waiver has been in place for many years and regulates irrigated pasture operations out of the Bridgeport Valley. I'm sure that you're all very familiar with this permit. In the southern portion of the region, we have 4 dairies under individual waste discharge requirements. As a note, Victorville staff are in the process of developing a confined animal feeding operations general order. We also have PG&E's agricultural treatment units associated with remediation of hexavalent chromium near Hinckley. Staff will be evaluating all permits for any needed revisions due to the recent statewide presidential requirements. This slide shows the percentage of crop types and commodities for irrigated agriculture in the region. The total number of irrigated acres is estimated to be approximately 152,000 acres. As you can see from the slide, an overwhelming majority of the estimated irrigated acres in the region are pasture and alfalfa, or approximately 125,000 acres. It is worth noting that El Dorado, Nevada, Placer, and Sierra counties do not have irrigated agriculture, at least based off the data set that we used that I'll talk about in just a moment. The data used to estimate the total irrigated acres in the Lahontan region was derived from Department of Water Resources data from 2014. The data set that staff used to calculate the total acres is consistent with data used by other regions for similar calculations and estimate. LandIQ, a consulting firm contracted by DWR, produced the 2014 statewide land use data derived from aerial imagery and satellite data. The overall accuracy results for the crop mapping statewide was approximately 96%, so pretty accurate. The Lahontan region is over 600 miles long, stretching from Oregon border in Modoc County all the way to the Mojave Desert. This presents a number of challenges, including how to display data and other information in maps at a scale that is appropriate and readable. Thanks to the excellent GIS and cartography skills by Kathleen, we elected to display the region's irrigated agriculture in three separate maps, one for north, one for central and southern portion of the region. This map shows the northern portion of the region in Modoc and Lassen counties. The irrigated agriculture is depicted in green shading. Right here. Here's an example of it. The blue shading on the map are water bodies such as Eagle Lake and Honey Lake. The green and blue on the map do not correspond to the colors in the pie chart. The pie chart represents the proportion of different irrigated agricultural commodities within the inset map of the Lahontan region. Two noteworthy pieces of information from this slide are the proportion of irrigated ag is composed, the vast proportion of irrigated ag is composed of mixed pasture and alfalfa. And there's a small amount of wild rice along Highway 395 northeast of Susanville. Approximately in here somewhere, in one of these green blobs in here is some wild rice. There's a picture of it right here, which I took. Well, Google Earth deserves the photo credit, but that's kind of what it looks like. There's 395 headed north. This slide shows the central portion of the region in Alpine, Mono, and Inyo counties. Here again, the predominant commodities are alfalfa and mixed pasture. The small sliver of other crop types are dates and deciduous trees. This slide shows the distribution of irrigated lands in the southern portion of the region. The irrigated agriculture here is in Los Angeles, San Bernardino, and Kern counties. The next slide shows the breakdown of crop types within the southern portion of the region. Here is the breakdown. Again, the pie chart represents the proportion of irrigated agriculture for Kern, Los Angeles, and San Bernardino counties by crop type. As you can see, about 75% of the crops in the southern region are alfalfa. If you have never seen alfalfa in the desert, it is a very stark contrast between sand dunes and lush green crop fields. The picture in the upper right-hand corner depicts that. Another noteworthy crop in the southern region are pistachios. The picture in the lower left side of the slide shows a newly planted pistachio orchard near Daggett. Irrigated pasture and alfalfa make up the majority of the irrigated acres in the Lahontan region at approximately 82%. This slide shows the breakdown of irrigated pasture and alfalfa by county. The majority of the irrigated pasture and alfalfa occur in the northern counties within the region, with the exception probably of Los Angeles County. This slide shows the breakdown of crops in the region that are not irrigated pasture, alfalfa, or idle. Idle land is classified as agricultural lands that have the potential to be irrigated or have been irrigated in the past but are not currently receiving irrigation water. These other crop types make up approximately 9% of the total irrigated acres in the region, or approximately 13,000 acres. Now we have covered the distribution of irrigated ag in the region, I'd like to switch to irrigation methods. This slide shows different irrigation methods by crop type and estimated water usage in acre feet per acre. The first is alfalfa, which is generally irrigated through center pivot sprinklers or bubblers. Photographs of a center pivot are in the center of the slide with wheel-line sprinklers in the upper or mid-right-hand portion of the slide. For trees and orchards, generally drip irrigation is utilized. The picture in the lower left is of an orchard of pistachios near Ridgecrest, and also a newly planted pistachio orchard near Daggett. Irrigated pasture in the region can be irrigated a number of different ways. A common irrigation method is flood irrigation, and I will be covering that in more detail in the next slide. Also included in this slide is approximate water usage of the different irrigation types, with approximately 5 feet per acre per year for center pivots, wheel line sprinklers associated with alfalfa, 3.5 acres feet per year for orchard crops using drip irrigation, and approximately 4.1 acre feet per year for irrigated pasture utilizing flood irrigation. Although the regional boards do not directly regulate water usage, the amount of water applied does play a significant role in predicting migration of pollutants into surface and groundwaters. For example, greater water efficiency generally results in less transport of nitrates and other naturally occurring pollutants such as selenium or arsenic into groundwater. The presidential requirements that have been established in the Irrigated Lands Program, such as the Irrigation and Nitrogen Management Presidential Requirement, may be an opportunity for each regional board to look more closely at the amount of irrigation water applied and the amount of nitrogen removed by the crops to better address areas where nitrogen is contributing to overall groundwater degradation. Many of the salt nutrient management plans that have been adopted in the region provide an estimate of assimilative capacity of the groundwater basin for these types of contaminants, such as arsenic, nitrate, and total dissolved solid. In those areas where assimilative capacity has been met or is likely to be met within several decades, specific management practices and monitoring may be necessary as part of the Irrigated Lands Program order. I will go into greater detail on the salt nutrient management plan in later slides. Flood irrigation in our region typically starts with the surface water diversion of a creek or is conveyed to the head of a pasture via canal. The water is spread as evenly as possible across the pasture via a series of breaks or checks in the diversion ditch. At the lower end of the pasture, the water can be captured again and may discharge back to the creek or canal as tailwater return flow. A good example of this, again, is the Bridgeport Valley in Mono County. Bridgeport Valley has the largest acres of irrigated pasture in the region, and is aerial imagery of the Bridgeport Valley is in the lower right-hand corner of the slide. Now that we have characterized the type of irrigated agriculture and the geographic scope of irrigated acres in the region, I'd like to talk more specifically about some known or suspected water quality impacts from irrigated ag. But before we dive right into the water quality issues, I would like to take a moment to provide an overview of the potential water quality impacts to surface and groundwater from irrigated agriculture. The impacts captured in this slide are not necessarily specific to the Lahontan region, but are germane to the impacts seen across the state and the country. In terms of surface water impacts, irrigated crops can have greater impact to water quality compared to dry land farming. Applied irrigation water can increase erosion rates, leading to increased sediment yields to surface waters. Also, tailwater return flow and drainage of irrigated fields can lead to accelerated transport of pollutants. Many pollutants, such as pesticides, metals, and nutrients, can bind to soil particles and be transported to surface waters. For groundwater, we know that crops transpire pure water from soil, leaving concentrated dissolved salts where the irrigation source water is naturally high in minerals. Where fertilizer and irrigation used by crops is not perfectly efficient, this may lead to leaching residual nitrates and salts into groundwater. Naturally occurring toxic elements such as arsenic, uranium, and selenium in soils may be mobilized also by irrigation. Accumulation of selenium in the Kesterson Reservoir in the Central Valley is an example of irrigation-induced toxicity problems, which some of you may be familiar with that issue. This slide shows a section of the Susan River and Honey Lake in Lassen County. The different crop types along the river and the lake are shown here in the legend. Susan River is currently 303D listed for TDS, mercury, nitrogen, turbidity, and unknown toxicity. Honey Lake is listed for arsenic, salinity, TDS, and chlorides. The purpose of this slide is to show an area that is suspected of having surface water quality issues associated with agriculture. This is an area within the region where we might want to create specific permit and program requirements to address these listings. The presidential requirements have enough flexibility to provide maximum discretion for staff, including any requirements in terms of irrigation and nitrogen management, erosion control, planning and implementation, management practice reporting, water quality monitoring and evaluation, and education and outreach. This slide shows the Antelope Valley groundwater basin and the overlying irrigated agriculture. In terms of known groundwater quality impacts, the best source of current and future projections of salt and nutrient water quality impacts are adopted salt nutrient management plans. 5 salt nutrient management plans have been completed in the Lahontan region: Antelope Valley, Mojave, Fort Irwin, Indian Wells Valley, and Fremont Valley. Salt nutrient management plans in progress are the Owens Valley, South Tahoe, and Honey Lake. The Antelope Valley Salt Nutrient Management Plan indicates possible geologic sources of arsenic, boron, fluoride, and chromium. Results of the 25-year Salt Nutrient Management Plan loading model simulations for salt and nutrients in the Antelope groundwater basin are summarized on the next slide. These are the total number of irrigated agricultural acres in the Antelope Valley, with alfalfa leading the way at approximately 17,000. This table comes from the Antelope Valley Salt Nutrient Management Plan. We selected this basin to highlight in this presentation because of the prevalence of irrigated acres, which are shown in the previous slide. The take-home message from this slide is that the 25-year loading model finds TDS and arsenic of concern, but not nitrate. Conclusions from the Salt Nutrient Management Plan are that ag's contribution to nitrate is not significant, and only about 1/3 of the loading associated with TDS and arsenic. The majority of the TDS loading comes from municipal and industrial uses. Staff will need to carefully evaluate each salt nutrient management plan and determine where an appropriate requirements for an irrigated lands program to ensure that the groundwater is adequately protected. This slide provides a summary of the specific agricultural water quality impacts as indicated in 4 different salt nutrient management plans in the Lahontan region. Significant TDS and nitrates associated with irrigated ag are in Indian Wells Valley. Impacts will increase significantly with time as the pistachio crops mature and additional pistachio crops are installed. Also in the Antelope Valley, TDS exceeds a similar capacity, and arsenic has already exceeded a similar capacity. Salt nutrient impacts are relatively small and moderate in the Mojave Basin and negligible in the Fort Irwin Basin. Another factor that will need to be considered in the development of an irrigated ag program are critically overdrafted groundwater basins as identified by the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act. There is 1 critically overdrafted groundwater basin in the region, Indian Wells Valley. The map is zoomed into only the agricultural portion of the basin, which highlights the growing trend of pistachio farms and alfalfa. The Salt Nutrient Management Plan for Indian Wells indicates that some portion of TDS loading is due to alfalfa and pistachios. Total nitrate loading may be as high as 45% from pistachios compared to 36% from septic and 4% from wastewater treatment plants. This may be relevant in the development of an ag program because we want to be consistent in our regulations to conform with the groundwater sustainability plans established by the groundwater sustainability agencies as part of the Groundwater Sustainability Management Act. This could come into play with the precedential requirements like the irrigation and nitrogen management precedential requirement, where applied versus removed ratios must be balanced to reduce the risk of additional contaminants leaching to groundwater. As I mentioned in the last slide, there is a growing trend or expansion of pistachio orchards in the Indian Wells Valley. This is an area of the region that is expanding the most rapidly in terms of irrigated agriculture. I will show you a number of aerial images starting in 2010 and ending in 2019 to illustrate that point. The image that you see here is a Google Earth image from April 2019. I'd like to focus your attention on these areas that are east of Highway 395 and north of this road that goes down towards Ridgecrest, I believe. This is the same image from May of 2010 and then May of 2013. 2010, 2013. So you can see there, sometime between those 2 days, there was a fair amount of development of ag, mostly in the form of pistachio orchards, which are, you can see pretty well from the highway when you're whizzing by on Highway 395. A presentation about irrigated ag wouldn't be complete without at least one slide on pesticides. I'm not going to go into a great deal about agricultural pesticide application during this presentation because staff are still in the preliminary stages of investigating their uses in our region. What we have learned is that California Department of Pesticide Regulation reports annual chemical uses on a county-by-county basis. Only Inyo and Mono counties are entirely within the Lahontan region. Preliminary pesticide data analysis has been conducted by our staff for Inyo and Mono counties only because pesticide users are not identified by name or by geospatial location in the California Department of Pesticide Regulation database. So the data for the county split between waterborne regions cannot be separated out by region. Staff has started to develop hazard ranking using criteria such as environmental persistence, mobility, and toxicity. Again, the results of that analysis are very preliminary, and I won't be going into further detail at this time, but it is important to note here that we are looking into it, and we'll be able to share more information possibly next year if we have a second workshop on this item. Now we have successfully gone through a brief history of irrigated agriculture regulation in California, a synopsis of the East San Joaquin Order and its precedential requirements, a summary of the various regional board irrigated lands programs. We learned about existing ag in the Lahontan region, and we reviewed some of the known surface and groundwater quality issues related to irrigated ag. So as we approach the end of the presentation, I want to recap on the precedential requirements again so that it's fresh in your mind and may stimulate good discussion and questions. Here are some things to think about and questions to ponder. For irrigation and nitrogen management, where in our region do we have an intersection of irrigated agriculture and nitrogen issues? Where might we want to focus our attention for required field-level nitrogen applied versus removed ratios in tracking and development of crop-specific nitrogen removal coefficients? In terms of erosion control planning and implementation, where in our region do we have documented issues of sediment and erosion issues associated with irrigated agriculture? What areas are more prone to erosion and sedimentation than others? For management practice reporting, what templates are out there with other regions that we would be appropriate for management practice reporting in our region? For water quality monitoring and evaluation, where might we require annual nitrate sampling for individual on-farm drinking water wells? Where would it be more appropriate to use a coordinated monitoring strategy between larger groups of growers? In education and outreach, how might we structure our education and outreach program? What examples do we have from other regions? For record keeping and third-party coalitions, depending on where the program is focused, on watershed-based coalition groups or commodity groups, what should be the specific requirements and certification process for these groups? These are some preliminary questions that we are asking ourselves at this time. Many of the answers to these questions will be addressed during the development steps for the program. Here are the development steps. Planning. Generally, in this step, regions identify the need for the regulations, conduct planning, public outreach, and obtain approvals for order adoption. In enrollment, regions approve third-party coalition groups to carry out requirements of the order. Growers enroll as individual or as third-party groups. Enrollment enforcement. Regions identify potential non-enrollees and take progressive action to ensure that all dischargers are enrolled. Implementation. Growers, third parties implement requirements established by the order. Regions monitor compliance. Implementation enforcement. Regions take progressive action on enrollees and coalition groups not in compliance. Adaptive management. Regions and third parties determine adaptive strategies to achieve water quality standards, which may include special determination projects. Regions 3, 4, and 5 have well-established irrigated lands programs and have completed steps 1 through 5 above. Regions 2, 7, 8, and 9 have completed the first three steps. The Lahontan region and the North Coast region are in the preliminary stages of program development and find themselves squarely in the first stage of or planning. So in conclusion, here are some recommended next steps. Staff will be looking into key issues such as pesticides. We are also looking closely at other regional approaches and lessons learned. We will be coordinating closely with State Board as well. Based on feedback received tonight and direction from the board, staff intend to prepare a staff report over the next 6 to 8 months, outlining options for a regulatory approach and permitting framework. A second workshop sometime in spring or summer of 2020 is proposed. Between now and then, staff would conduct outreach to stakeholder groups such as County Ag Commissioners, Farm Bureau, California Department of Food and Ag, and others. Following a second workshop, staff would start further developing program approach and the permit. We would also need to include a CEQA document, of course, and scoping meetings associated with that. In addition to some of the questions that I posed during the presentation, some other questions that staff are looking for board direction. Given the scope and nature of irrigated agriculture in the region, should we be developing an irrigated ag program at this time? Currently, we have no resources dedicated to this effort, and there are no proposals in the pipeline right now with State Board for additional positions. Any effort to develop this program would come from existing staff resources, potentially from several programs. What permitting approach would be most appropriate for the Lahontan region? Would it be a geographic, a watershed-based, or a commodity-specific approach? Depending on the approach, would we encourage third-party coalition groups or enroll growers individually? Are there specific areas of irrigated ag in the region that we want to focus more than others, such as 303D listings, areas where there have been established salt nutrient management plans, or critically overdrafted groundwater basins per SGMA? What other opportunities do we have for incentivizing things like water use efficiency or groundwater recharge through the development of this program? That concludes my presentation. I would be happy to address any questions or comments that the board might have.
Thank you very much. What I'd like to do at this point is take a short break. And then when we return, I'd like to take questions from the board members, questions only. And then, as I said, we have one speaker card, so if there's anyone else other than the one card, please get that card to us. After that, then we'll have comments and discussion by the board. So if we could be back in place at 8:10, thank you very much.
Nevada County, Yuba Center, Glenn County over to Humboldt County, and everything north of that to the Oregon and Nevada borders. Came up Highway 50 this late afternoon from Sacramento. I was there for an all-day meeting in Sacramento today, and as I was driving up, I was thinking, this is a stretch of highway that in all of my travels of, I figured out that I'm approaching 750,000 miles for Farm Bureau alone in my career, that I've never been on. So I wish it hadn't have been quite so cloudy, because it looked like it was really beautiful. But and Ben, when you do get to come up to MODOC, we have two seasons, snow removal and construction. So we keep it simple for you. So a little bit about my operation and operating under the Central Valley Irrigated Lands Program. Irrigated pasture exclusively, very similar to the 82% figure that Ben showed you in your region. I'm actually only a couple of miles from being in the Lahontan region, where I'm located on a tributary to the Pitt River. The inputs to my operation are three: soil, sunshine, and irrigation water. That is the entirety of what goes into my irrigated pasture. I graze cattle on it, and the crop is calves in about another month, hopefully at 700 plus pounds at about 10 months of age off of grass. I don't farm it. The pasture that I operate on has probably been in the same irrigated pasture for over 50 years. That is the norm with irrigated pasture. 20 to 50 plus years. The only time that you see disturbance of the soil on an irrigated pasture operation is if you're going to level the land to have increased irrigation efficiency. Quite honestly, cows don't pay that bill. It doesn't happen. I wish that problem could exist financially, but there isn't that kind of money in cattle, particularly in the higher elevations. Absolutely no fertilizer, and that is not by choice of wanting to be organic or anything to that nature. It's purely an economic return issue. Irrigated pasture, high elevations, short growing season. I want my nitrogen to come with clover, because my cattle do better with clover and a grass mixture. And that provides the nitrogen that the grass needs. I don't apply any nitrogen whatsoever. That's the norm of the Lassen, MODOC, and even down into Bridgeport and the Bishop areas for irrigated pasture. Pesticides, I can make some of your work real easy, Ben. We don't apply. The only thing that I apply pesticides to is a single application spot spray on noxious weeds. In my area, the problem is Scotch thistle, very invasive, and it's something that I spend many Saturdays and Sundays out there with a backpack sprayer, literally doing a spot application to them. As I said, quite typical of that 82% figure of your irrigated land in this region, this pasture and alfalfa. I don't personally grow any alfalfa. I ship my cows down into the Sacramento Valley and let them run on winter native feed. However, yesterday afternoon, I found out the place I'm supposed to go to isn't available. So It'll be interesting next couple weeks here trying to find a replacement for that. But moving along, just a couple comments based on some of the presentation you received. The rice acreage in Lassen County, I used to work on that farming operation. That's Alturas Ranches. I can tell you that you don't have any rice, and it's actually wall rice, which is an aquatic grass, not a rice, growing anymore. That data from 14 was accurate, but today, because of the market, there isn't any wild rice grown on that operation. It's strictly alfalfa and cereal grains. Little bit concerned about the numbers that I saw in the presentation on applied irrigation rates. I would like to see a little bit of ground truthing on that, particularly working with the University of California Ag Extension. I think that those numbers are quite high. You might be looking at total needs for the crop for the year, but you have to remember that most of our moisture does come in the winter months in the form of soil, and we rely, we mine that winter water that's in the soil and only add water back as it is available. So those numbers seemed quite high. Sediment, as I mentioned before, off of irrigated pasture in particular, is essentially non-existent because we aren't disturbing the soils. Just a few things and kind of in general about irrigated lands programs. I would hope that you encourage your staff to work to develop existing baselines of surface and groundwater data regarding irrigated agriculture, and in particular, where there are impacts to that surface and groundwater from irrigated agriculture. I heard some stuff, but also, you know, and it did get into the very far southern portion of the region, which I have to admit I've been through, but and have seen those pistachio orchards, but am definitely not that familiar with. But I, even there, it was commented that the accedances were most likely coming from a majority of an urban influence and an industrial, not an agricultural. Existing groundwater monitoring wells, in particular in relation to nitrates, and whether those are related to agriculture. I'm going to kind of jump ahead in what I was thinking about saying. Ben had the 1 through 6 points of steps of development of an irrigated lands program and said that Central Valley and a couple others were at 5. I would beg to differ that Central Valley is at the threshold of stepping into 6. In 3 weeks' time, the Central Valley Board will be at their board meeting in Reading, taking a very serious look at a low-threat agricultural program. This is something that those of us in Plumas, Sierra, Lassen, Shasta, Modoc counties in particular have been asking for a long time, because the Central Valley program is basically one size fits all. And, you know, some of you could probably slip my boot on and do just fine. Some of you might be a little bit sliding around in it, and some of you wouldn't be able to get your foot into it. And that's the same with an irrigated lands program. My agriculture, the agriculture of those counties that I just named off, is vastly different than the agriculture in Tulare and Kern and Kings County, where it's a very intensive row cropping and orchards, vastly different inputs and results. But yet the Central Valley program to date has been one size fits all. With that in mind, I would urge you as a board to really consider looking at a low threat, been mentioned possibly regional, looking at the makeup of the northern and the central portions of that, where 80%+ of that was irrigated pasture and alfalfa, I think would fit really nicely into a low threat program. The problems we have, in particular where we are on the upper reaches of the Pitt River, is we're asked to monitor, required to monitor, I shouldn't say ask, we're required to monitor for things that we don't even use in our type of agriculture. Yes, there are issues in the San Joaquin Valley, but you know, we don't do it. We shouldn't have to spend money to do it. An offshoot of that is in Goose Lake, just to the north of where I'm located. The money that little tiny coalition around Goose Lake is spending on required monitoring has completely dried up work that they were doing to habitat improvement for red band trout. The farmers and ranchers there are just pulling their hair out, going, we can't do what needs to be done because we're spending every dime available doing monitoring for things that we're not even using in the area. That is part of the emphasis on the Central Valley, looking at this low threat. So I would really encourage that. As much as I have personally cussed the coalition I'm in, I also realize from looking at it from a 30,000-foot elevation level that coalitions or third-party programs are the only way for this to work. Individually, there's no way that I can do the required monitoring myself to be in compliance. It would mean that ground is dried up. Then there's a sort of sediment coming off of it, chances of it becoming rural ranchettes and the associated problems with that. And also from your staff perspective, they cannot, unless you have a small army of staff, handle every one of us individually. And that's where the coalition model that has gone through some bumps but is being perfected, particularly in the Central Valley, should be what you aim for. One thing that I heard regarding the crop-specific nitrogen applications, the State Water Resources Control Board expert panel was clear that this should not occur and that nitrogen application / removal and nitrogen applied versus removed figures are not regulatory endpoints. There's so much variance with crops and soil types and the likes of that is not a useful tool. And I would, go back to what I said earlier about, let's look to see where there's really nitrate issues. Absent issues, there are provisions in that East San Joaquin order that is precedent setting over all of the regions for exclusions and exemptions. It is present there. And just one final item regarding fecal coliform counts. The state board, again, has recommended that all boards adopt the U.S. EPA guidance of 100 CFA per 100 milliliter of E. coli, not using the fecal coliform counts that I'm familiar with being utilized in this region. So I would encourage you, as you're moving forward, to look at that. That concludes my comments, and I would encourage you to work with the county farm bureaus throughout this very vast and very different region, and also California Farm Bureau. We're here to help represent our grower members, but also to get a program that truly benefits water quality and doesn't drive irrigated agriculture out of existence. So, thank you.
Thank you. Questions for, well, one second. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to address the board with respect to this item? Okay. Questions for either presenter? Mr. Dias.
Yes, thank you. I have some questions for Ben. First of all, excellent presentation.
Thanks.
And if we could, I'd like to go back to your slide number 8, if it's available.
All right, he's working on it.
At any rate, this slide is titled Summary of Regional ILRP Programs. Mm-hmm. That's it. Thank you. I just find it very interesting to note that.
Oops. Okay, there we are.
I find it interesting to note how far ahead many of the other regions are ahead of us. And I was very pleased to hear you say that you and our staff would be gathering lessons learned from the other regions. I strongly encourage that as well. But if you have had any conversations with counterparts in other regions, have they indicated to you how farmers and ranchers in their regions have received the ILRP?
Well, a little bit of my history with the Water Board. I started working for the Water Board in 2008 for the Central Valley Water Board, and I was hired as a half PY or half the position for the layperson. Dairies and half a position in the irrigated lands program. And this was right kind of in that time frame I was talking about where the Central Valley was developing its long-term irrigated ag program. So I had the pleasure of attending a lot of the stakeholder meetings during the development of that program. The first stakeholder I attended was in Rancho Cordova, and there were CHP outside to try to control any sort of, you know, anything that might happen. Luckily, nothing did happen, but people in stakeholder groups came in buses, and people had a lot to say. I focused mostly out of the Reading office and actually worked quite a bit with the coalition groups that Ned mentioned earlier, including the Goose Lake Coalition group and the Upper Pitt Watershed group and the Feather River. And in those regions, there was predominantly irrigated pasture. And there was a pretty rough adjustment period, I would say, during the first...
How many years, Ned, do you think?
For a while, as that program got established. I think, you know, to his points, I think a lot of the bumps in the road were smoothed out as we made more progress with refining the work that the coalition groups did. But you have to understand that, you know, and this goes back a little bit to the history piece, agriculture just hasn't really been regulated in the same way that other industries have, you know, across the country. And California elected to pursue regulation of irrigated agriculture under our authority of Port of Cologne. But it was somewhat uncharted territory in a lot of ways. And so it was, there was a fair amount of, you know, adjustment and you know, disgruntlement from that discharger group as we started to establish those programs. But I think, you know, eventually, you know, as long as, you know, for these, for crops like irrigated pasture and alfalfa, which are relatively low, the revenue generated on a per acre basis is relatively low. And so as long as you tailor a program that meets the minimum requirements of and establishes, you know, sufficient protection of groundwater quality, but it doesn't break the bank in terms of what the dischargers are having to pay for fees, and demonstrates some measurable amount of water quality improvement, whether it's industry monitoring or habitat improvement projects like Mr. Coe referred to, I think that goes a long way towards making the discharger feel like it's a worthwhile endeavor.
Well, with your experience in the Central Valley, I'd say we are very lucky to have you in our region helping us to implement the program. Thank you. No more questions.
Ms. Cox?
Thank you, Chair. Ben, you used a term I wasn't familiar with, young perennial. What does that describe?
Say it again.
Young perennial. It's in your graphs and mentioned in your oral presentation.
I think that was regard to perennial grasses, probably, which is just you know, a certain type of crop that you know, growers produce. Yeah.
Okay, I wasn't familiar with that, and I think you show there's 56 acres of young perennials. Also, I was curious by what you shared about higher nitrates with pistachios. Can you, is that because the nitrates are applied to make the plants grow, or is that somehow naturally occurring from the activity of growing pistachio trees?
I am not familiar with the actual agronomy associated with growing pistachios. I do have Dr. Bruce Warden in the audience, though, who might be able to share something about that.
Hello, members of the board. I'm Bruce Warden in the non-point source unit in the South Lake Tahoe office. Typically, in our region, I have seen nothing but drip irrigated pistachios, and in those systems, they would apply fertilizer with the irrigation water, so it goes right to the roots. And quite often, that's at high concentration, so the possibility of leaching is there. The high numbers you're mentioning came out of the Indian Wells Valley model, that the loading model that went with the salt nutrient management plan. So that was their analysis based on their modeling and monitoring efforts there primarily.
It's very interesting. Okay. There was a tremendous amount of alfalfa on your chart shown in Antelope Valley as well as the southern, I guess it would be the eastern Mojave region that's covered by the Mojave Water Agency. Those are both now adjudicated groundwater basins, and I think over time, Ben, we're going to see with the ramp downs and the intervention of the courts, we're going to see alfalfa eventually going away in those regions. And as you know, you've shared in your picture on the upper right there how odd it looks to drive out in the desert, particularly in the southern Lahontan region in the Newberry Springs area, understanding that that is an overdrafted groundwater basin, and you see sand and these beautiful, beautiful fields of alfalfa. A lot of that goes back to the economics. In that arid climate, unlike up in the Lassen County area that we heard, these farmers can get 7 cuttings of alfalfa per season at 5 to 7 acre feet of water per acre of alfalfa produced. So it's a highly productive area. But I really think over time we're going to see these go out as the water is picked up for growth and development and human needs. I do feel as a state we have an obligation to feed the people of our state, and in some cases the Central Valley feeding the country with some of the fruits and vegetables. So I think we have to balance all of that in our considerations here. As we move forward, looking at the potential of developing a policy for our region, I think we need to take it on a region-by-region basis, you know, upper, middle, southern. What are the climate conditions? What are the surface bodies of water, that sort of thing? And allow the maximum flexibility and particularly learn from the other regions, as Mr. Dias mentioned. There's also an awful lot of outreach that can be done through existing organizations like the RCDs and the NRCS, which are very active among the agricultural communities. But personally, I would hate to see us invest a lot of otherwise stressed staff resources on, you know, spending a great deal of time on programs like this when there may be some lower-hanging fruit in some of our other programs that we can put the efforts in that will result in greater water quality protection than what we may find in doing an irrigated lands program, but those are just my thoughts. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Horn?
Thank you, Chair. I have questions for both, and I'd like to start with Mr. Coe, if that's okay.
You don't want me looking at your notes?
First of all, I want to thank you so much for making the long drive down here and sharing your expertise and experience with us. It's been very helpful to me to hear what you have had to share with us. And also, I want to congratulate you for living in one of the most beautiful places on earth.
Just don't tell too many people.
So I'm familiar with Surprise Valley and Cedarville, not so familiar with the Upper Pitt River area. First a general question. How much confidence do you have? So in the past, I once had a job where I had to I tracked county level agricultural data in the Sierra, or in part of the Sierra. And what I got from year to year changed dramatically within a county. And I don't know if that means people are changing out what they're growing year to year, or whether it was faulty data, or do you have any thoughts about that?
What was the source of the data that you were seeing?
The County Farm Bureau. I may not have the time. It was whoever in the county was the agriculture.
The Farm Bureau is a voluntary membership, private membership organization, and we don't collect data like that.
Ag Commissioner?
The Ag Commissioners of the counties
prepare. Yeah. This was a while ago.
An annual crop report.
Yeah.
And that is dependent upon survey responses and then expanding that out to a full county level.
Okay.
And it's more geared towards the dollar value of the crop produced in the county, and you will see much more variability in areas where climate and topography allows you to change crops, unless you're in a permanent vineyard or orchard, because your establishment costs and times are so huge.
Right.
Like I said, in my case and the all of the surrounding ranches around me, I don't think there's anybody that could tell you when that ground was not in the current crop of permanent pasture.
Right.
And that's going to be more the norm of the northern two-thirds of your region.
Right. So what is the best source of data about agriculture, crops, and that sort of
thing? The Ag Commissioner's report is going to be your best source, yes.
Oh, wow. Okay.
But, as was indicated with pesticide information in Ben's presentation, that's a countywide. Mm-hmm. So, I'll take my home county, Modoc.
Mm-hmm.
Modoc is straddled by three different regional water quality control boards. And being able to say that, this portion of it is Lahontan and this portion of it is North Coast or Central Valley.
It's hard to tell.
The information is a higher level than that.
Right. Let's see. Sorry, I'm a little jet lagged, so.
That's all right. It gives me a chance to catch up too.
Okay. What was I going to ask next? Between irrigated and non-irrigated agriculture, so even if crops might be different year to year, will irrigated agriculture acres remain irrigated? Is that stable, irrigated ag, in terms of acres? Not necessarily the crops that are grown.
Right. No, I understand your question. Generally, it is going to be, because if you have water, a water right to surface water or groundwater,
okay.
That means that you've developed to a level that absent water, it's not financially viable to go to dry land unless there are outside forces that force that, and a huge looming one is going to be Sigma,
right.
and the impact in the overdrafted basins. Fortunately, this region is fairly immune to that, but that's going to be something that will create some change to what acreages are irrigated in the region. And and just to kind of highlight the vast differences of the region from Modoc to Riverside and San Bernardino counties, Board Member Cox, you'd commented about 7 plus cuttings of alfalfa. Modoc, Lassen, 3. Occasionally, you'll literally get lucky and get a 4th. In Modoc, we do not have a frost-free month of the year. It can freeze and has froze and snowed every month of the year. So it's kind of limiting of the crops that can be grown and also the yield. Mm-hmm. And as Ben indicated, and I just wanted to reiterate it, the most of the fees regarding irrigated lands programs have been on a per acre basis. While it's, you know, definitely somebody who's operating in the San Joaquin Valley, they know that they're paying the fee. It's a much smaller percentage of their total operating costs than it is on somebody who has irrigated pasture. You have vast acreages of it and very low return per acre. So that fee being set across the region has a huge impact on particularly the grazing pasture lands. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and if it is not grazed, then basically its only use is dryland grazing.
Right.
And then you're talking hundreds and hundreds of acres per animal unit.
Right, yeah. So I'm curious to know more about whether, so in my first reading of this material, so starting from, I've got a steep learning curve, I admit.
Well, I can appreciate that. I'm about a year into being a supervisor.
Oh.
And Monday and Tuesday we had budget hearings, my first round of that. And Sunday night I received most of the spreadsheets.
Yeah,
so.
Right. Okay. So on first blush, what made sense to me was doing a watershed approach to this. So that's an area smaller probably than the regional approach of that was shown in the PowerPoint. So in the case of your ranch, considering other ranches in the watershed, how would an approach like that work?
In a coalition, you need enough economy size to have economy of scale.
Right.
So, you know, and I'm speaking off the cuff right now, but I would say that a watershed approach in my county would be Surprise Valley. And I don't think that it has the size to support a coalition by itself. Depending on what ended up being in an irrigated lands program. I could, you know, here again, just speaking really frankly, I could see something that was MODOC-Lassen down to the Truckee River or something to that nature, you know, being a possible coalition that could support with the irrigated ag there. But, you know, we're just throwing stuff against the wall right now, too.
Right, right. So within whatever geographic area we choose to consider, could you see a way in which performance-based regulation might work? So within that region, the direction would be a certain amount of change or in assimilative capacity or something. I don't know. I mean, but not telling you how to do it. Does that make any sense to you?
How I would see that is working closely with Cooperative Extension and the water quality experts that are already working with us. And where there's an identified problem, looking at various ways that can be addressed. So, you know, I would tend to, on the surface, agree with what you were just saying. Yes.
Oh, okay, cool. And then the issue of assimilative capacity. So is that something you think about on your ranch and in the upper Pitt River, assimilative capacity of the groundwater basin?
I'm not sure what you're referencing.
Okay, well, that answers my question, I think. Okay. I think that's...
Ben Stern?
Yeah, I think so. Come on up, Ben.
Right. We're tag teaming this well.
Yeah. Well, so I'm curious what you think about the a performance-based approach.
Well, it is something we try to emphasize in our region. We've done so through our Tahoe Team DL and our Timber Waiver are good examples. And a performance-based approach is, instead of focusing sort of on the final output, which is sort of in-stream water quality measurement, like turbidity or nutrients or something like that, you focus more on some of the intermediary outputs. So in
That's
a,
not how I would describe it, but anyway.
So in the form of a regulatory permit, that might look like the reducing, you know, stream bank erosion. It might look like total linear feet of exclusion fencing, you know, installed. It might look like increasing, you know, canopy closure, you know, along streams, things of that nature. So I think that it's certainly a possibility in the context of an irrigated ag program. I'm not sure that it's been done anywhere in the state in terms of the other regional boards. Brianna is probably itching to come up and answer some questions, so she might be able to take a stab at that. But, you know, there's you know, 9 regional boards that are addressing irrigated agriculture, so certainly somewhere out there there's probably a model to look at that's, you know, either fits more my definition of performance-based or perhaps yours. But I think it's certainly a possibility, especially where we have a region where it's fairly homogenous in terms of the types of commodities. You know, I mean, we see overwhelmingly that our crops are alfalfa and grasses, you know, pasture. And you know, this slide, again, kind of illustrates some of the other crop types, but they make such a relatively small percentage and proportion of the total irrigated acres in our region. I'm not sure we would tailor a program to fit those commodity types.
Well, I mean, actually, I was thinking about... something like a Sigma approach for the Indian Wells area where you have everything from pasture to pistachios. And if it would work to have a coalition of people within that area negotiate their contribution to reduction of assimilative capacity or whatever, and that might then discourage more acres of things that are contributing a lot of TDS to the groundwater. And do you see what I'm getting at?
Sort of, yeah. Let the model for the permit influence sort of the economic considerations of what crop type that they would be
growing.
Yeah,
but the negotiation would be internal. It would not involve the water board. It would be internal to the people who are the agricultural, the farmers and ranchers who live there. Yeah. They would be like in Sigma. Uh-oh, here comes Brianna.
Yeah. Okay. Hi, I'm Brianna St. Pierre. I'm with the State Water Board now. I'm very happy to be back in front of you. I just want to jump in this conversation. I was going to be the quiet cheerleader in the back. But in the East San Joaquin, there are several spreadsheets that are that were developed for growers to report to coalitions, and then the coalitions would anonymize that data and then report that information to their regional water boards. That information includes what the crop type is for a given field, what their irrigation practices are, what their nitrogen application rates are, what their removal rates are, and then an A-R and an A over R, and then a three-year running average for those values. The coalition is then, when they compile that data, to look at outliers for similar crop types and as well as similar farming practices. So you can look at a performance-based metric where you're trying to kind of shrink that margin. So you, if you see an outlier as a coalition, you can work directly with that farmer to improve those management practices. So I think that kind of gets at where you're looking for a performance-based action to actively work with the farmers to have better management practices. There aren't any like hard targets, like you have to meet a one-to-one ratio or anything like that. Right. It's really, let's try and narrow that margin a little bit and work with those who are outliers to have some improved management practices.
Okay, thanks, that's helpful. Okay, Ben, I saved the toughest for last. I have a real hard time getting my head around assimilative capacity and the whole issue of assimilative capacity. And when I'm faced with, well, in this area, assimilative capacity will be exceeded in 100 years, then in this other area it'll be 150 years, it's like, what do I do with that information? I mean, is it okay to assimilate, to exceed assimilative capacity? What happens when we exceed assimilative capacity? Is there any kind of rule of thumb about what's acceptable in terms of the rate of decrease of assimilative capacity? I have all kinds of questions about that. And, you know, sort of like the anti-degradation policy. It's like, oh, this is a great idea, but I don't know what that means in terms of the decision space of a regional board.
Well, I'm still also becoming more familiar with assimilative capacity and salt nutrient management plans, so I would call on Dr. Bruce Warden again because he he helped me out with that portion of the presentation. Okay. Bruce, come on down.
Okay. All right, Bruce Warden again. The numbers you're referring to are associated with salt and nutrient management plans. Mm-hmm. They model when assimilative capacity will be met when you have concentrations that reach the water quality objectives. Mm-hmm. So that triggers a whole series of things when you get there. Could be, for example, a TMDL where you work on sources. Could be some other remedies, either permits or basin plan kind of remedies. But that's kind of, I think, functionally what it means. And these numbers just kind of give you some idea of whether or not it's going to be a problem, first off. Some of the models show that it's not going to, at least in the foreseeable future, as far as ahead as they could forecast, was not going to be exceeded. Others go quite some ways out and show, yeah, eventually, somewhere down the road, it's going to be exceeded. And then somewhere down the road, you're going to have to deal with it. I would hope that people look at these numbers and say, maybe we should start doing something now, but that's kind of a management decision and, you know, not necessarily a technical decision.
I mean, that's what occurs to me. It's like, okay, the people who are going to be living here in 150 years aren't going to thank us for not addressing this issue now and trying to postpone the date at which assimilative capacity gets exceeded.
So I think it gives you a gauge of kind of how serious the problem is. If it's a shorter time frame to reaching the water quality objectives, in other words, getting to your assimilative capacity, it helps manage, helps you with managing that problem. In other words, you can identify where the priorities, and that's where I would see the functional side of those kind of numbers. And I would hope that, like you're saying, that we would think ahead, right. Start working on those problems.
Okay, don't go away. Let me just review my list of questions and see if the main ones. Oh, one more question for Ben, or, I mean, whoever wants to answer this question. who's the right person to answer the question? So some crops, like rice in the Central Valley, are flood irrigated. And I've heard about pilot projects where almond orchards are flood irrigated as a means to recharge groundwater basins. And so I was wondering, so it's being flood irrigated as a benefit to the water supply. So how is that taken into consideration in irrigated land regulation?
I'll jump in on some of that. So as we've increased irrigation efficiency, mm-hmm. we've reduced groundwater recharge drastically.
Right.
When orchards in the Central Valley were all flood irrigated, groundwater was being recharged every year. The idea of drip irrigation is you apply the exact
right.
amount that that tree or vine needs and nothing else. You don't push water down. So some of where some of the Sigma's type things are looking at is, okay, what can we do, particularly in the winter months,
yeah.
to try and recharge? So, you know, with doing the right thing, sometimes you have other adverse consequences down the road. And, you know, and part of the efficiency is dictated by the finite supply of water that California has.
Yeah.
But yet, as was mentioned earlier, it feeds the nation and a good part of the world.
Right, yeah. So. Thank you. Up.
Could I add something to that?
Sure.
So water quality enters into this, too, in terms of salts.
Well, right.
So a point will be reached with drip irrigation where the salt begins to harm the trees in terms of yield and growth and so on. So at that point, agronomically, you would have to leach those salts out. So that's kind of a more long-term thing. So those salts don't get away. It depends quite a bit on what the geochemistry of the basin you're in. Some areas, it's not much of a problem, especially if you have a lot of snowfall.
Mm.
And you get pretty much an annual flushing, salts just don't accumulate. We don't have a problem here in Tahoe. I don't think you'd probably have a problem in Modoc County with
portions
salt.
Portions of Surprise Valley.
Portions, okay.
You know, because of the alkali lake.
It depends on the geochemistry. But, you know, you have to take into account kind of site-specific things, and that's something that Ned mentioned that I really appreciate him saying, that you have to, you know, consider the different climate, geology, soils of each area, because it's going to affect the management of that and should affect all of the water relations, water chemistry, water quality. So I think one of the good points of your talk is that we should try as much as we can to incorporate that into our irrigated lands program.
So, thank you.
Anyway.
Sorry, one more. Brianna St. Pierre. The other thing that is associated with the flood irrigation for purposes of groundwater recharge is I believe that's done in a way so you're not doing it with your fertilizer application.
Right, right.
So it's incorporating those best management practices. So you're flooding at a more beneficial time, so you're not just going to flush all of your nitrogen or your salt. I mean, the salt's already in the soil, but you're not going to additionally flush more than you need to, so you're not over-applying your nitrogen.
Right.
And with rice is a totally separate story. They've got hard pan, and that's not
right.
actually
that's
going
right.
down
that's
to
yeah.
well, the groundwater. So
yeah.
they're different.
I forgot. Thanks.
I didn't intend to make this a panel discussion, but it kind of worked out that way. So.
Yeah. Okay. I think I've taken up enough time, so thank you all for answering my questions.
Mr. Jardine.
Thank you. I'll keep mine short. I had a question of Modoc County. I'm somewhat familiar with the Alpine Federal Court decree on the Carson River and the Truckee River operating agreement that affects the upper lower Truckee down to Pyramid Lake and Lake Lahontan. Do you have those same regulations up in your neck of the woods? Court decrees or federal regulations?
Yes, and I'm going to speak to Surprise Valley because that's where I'm knowledgeable of. That is all adjudicated. It's all surface water coming out of the Warner Mountains, and those are adjudicated and water-mastered waters.
We have water master too, but federal. And once again, the approach that Lahontan, you would suggest Lahontan takes, would it be a watershed approach to management or a regional approach or collaboratives?
Well, I think it's something that all of us need to work towards. What will work for all? Because, you know, I'm not naive enough to realize that we can't just continue operating without an irrigated lands program. But at the same time, I don't want something that's based on San Bernardino County applied to Lassen or Modoc County.
You Absolutely.
Know, we are vastly different. And, you know, just like the Central Valley probably should be split into at least two different water boards. I could see your water board even split up more than that, but we're stuck with the map we have.
I just thank you, and I have to thank you, Ben, for all the hard work that you've done on this. You know, with limited resources, I think we're taking the first steps in the right direction. That's it for me.
Thank Mr. you. Sandell.
Thanks for the presentation. This is such a big field. It's beyond me to even think how we're going to get very much done with no extra resources. Seems almost impossible, actually. But on the other hand, it's nice that just as I get to go last here, we're getting to go last in terms of with the regional board so we can take advantage of what other people have done and where they've changed their minds and moved in a different direction. We can probably learn something from all of that. Assimilative capacity is something that's bothered me right along because it just seems like you're not necessarily, you're admitting that you're taking away from the future. You're limiting the options that people in the future will have because you're using up some of them now, and at some point you're going to run out. But it's going to be in the future, and you won't be around. So no problem. Seems to me that it would be nice if we were some of our thinking were to apply fertilizers at agronomic rates, which I think is probably done. But it wasn't mentioned by using that term. But in other words, just enough that just what the plant needs and not more, so you don't wind up getting nitrogen going to groundwater. But the other side of things going to groundwater is that it's not just nitrogen that we're applying. There are other things like pesticides that I'm not sure where they're in the mix and when. But if nitrogen is getting to groundwater, then probably so are pesticides. And there is a whole other thing because you don't know the fate of those. We've been talking about emerging contaminants. Well, there you go. Are you going to let any of those get to groundwater at all, ever? I mean, it seems to me the answer has got to be no, period. And so I'm not sure, you know, what we're doing about that to control that, but I think that when you talk about how we should be focusing our efforts, given our limited resources, it seems to me that we should be looking at population, looking at where most of the population is that would be affected by these practices, and making sure that we're not allowing pesticides near population centers. And we should focus first on toxicity as one of the things that we absolutely avoid, and toxicity also in terms of what gets to groundwater. There's a lot more about this. I'm sure we're going to be hearing more from you.
Yeah.
And so I'll save that for then.
I don't think I have any questions. The advantages Mr. Sandell pointed out of going last. And it was an excellent presentation. It's a huge amount of material and a huge amount to try to take in. And I think I was zipping along with interest and intrigue until you got to the point where you mentioned that we have no staff and no money. And then I began to wonder whether or not this was now shifted to the realm of an academic discussion, and how are we gonna pursue this if we don't have the resources to do that? So I think that's a real threshold question. It certainly informs the scope of how ambitious we want to be about this. I think everyone said it, and it's true. We need to, if we want to go down this path, and we have no way to go down it on our own, we're going to have to borrow rather heavily from people who have been down the path before. And I really appreciate Mr. Coe being here, because when I say people who have gone down the path before, I don't just mean regulatory agencies, our sister regional boards, but the people who have dealt with it from the other side of the fence, and what their experiences are, I think would be very, very valuable to us. I would hope that whatever we do, we find a way that correlates in what we do in an irrigated lands policy and program with what's going on in SGMA. It seems to me that these two things are inextricably tied to each other, if for no other reason than the SGMA is the current idea du jour of approaching all kinds of water issues, and it's going to drive our policy perhaps more than we're going to be able to drive it, and therefore we're going to have to figure out how to fit those two things together. And at least there are some resources in that area that we might be able to use beneficially to go forward. I wish us, and I really mean you, luck in trying to go forward with this. I think Mr. Sandell makes a good point. Do we want to apply our effort in locations which are in which the greatest amount of harm can come to people, or do we want to apply our efforts to situations in which the greatest amount of harm could come to the water resource? I don't know the extent to which those two things overlap. Or do we want to look at this giant picture on the wall that tells me that 3/4 of what we're dealing with is alfalfa, at least in this particular area showed on the slide, and does that drive what we're doing, or do we want to let that dictate how we want to design and roll out our program? I don't know the answers to those questions, and I don't know how those determinations were made in other regions, but I suspect that we need to mine the living bejesus out of the other people's experiences. Thank goodness you can help us do that within your own head, because you have done this before, and we're very fortunate to have that perspective and that background. I look forward to seeing how this rolls out, but I guess it's the time in every meeting where I say, gosh, I wish we had the resources to do what we're asked to do, and then sit quietly knowing that we don't, and it's probably not in the cards. So thanks a lot for the work you're doing, and I look forward to seeing what comes next.
Yeah, well, just a quick comment on that. I think we can cobble together enough resources to at least put together a thoughtful staff report to bring back to the board at some point with some, you know, a little bit more detail and some suggestions or options in any way of a different approaches that we might take. What we do after that, you know, we'll have to figure that out. But it would be nice to bring back something that for the board to review and hear again sometime in the near future.
Well, and I think it's true of all of us. I think we're going to be really interested knowing that we can't leap into this with both feet with your thoughts about how we initiate this program at an appropriate scale that it can be effective and manageable to us. I'm also mindful of the idea that what works in Modoc County is not the same as what happens in my county that also begins with an M, and is not similar to what happens in the South. And we need to be really clear about that as we go forward. There's a real temptation in all of this to just say, here's a plan and here's an idea and here's how we're going to do it. We're going to do it the same way everywhere. And it just doesn't work. It might work for the regulator, but it doesn't work very well for the people who have to deal with the consequences of that kind of an approach. So I know that we seem to have a handle on that concept, and so I'm sure we'll see it embedded in what you bring back to us. So thank you. Thank you for this very much.
Hi, Brianna again. I just have one more thing that I wanted to bring up because fees were mentioned earlier as the straight per acre fee and everyone pays the same based on how many acres they're farming. Just this morning, the state board adopted a new fee structure for the ag program in which there is a 20% discount in fees for recognized commodities that are low threat. So that includes the Rice Commission, irrigated pastures, and managed wetlands. And then there's also a caveat that matches the languages in the East San Joaquin order that if another group or commodity wanted to come forward that could demonstrate that they met the similar criteria that's in the East San Joaquin order, then they could also qualify for that 20% discount in fees. So hot off the press, just happened this morning. I just wanted to share that with you and the people in the room.
Thank you.
I just wanted to add something about resources. I guess I remain hopeful that we may at some point down the road get some resource assistance. Many of the other regions do have staff dedicated to irrigated lands program. Part of the good news of being last is you get to learn from people's mistakes and do it in a particular way. The bad news about being last is that you didn't get the resources that other people did because they did have an irrigated lands program. So I do believe if you build it, they will come, but it may not come right away.
Thank you. I was playing charades. I didn't know that was going to be part of the evening's entertainment, at least for me. That's the last item on our agenda for this evening. So thank you very much for your contribution and your hard work and for being here. And we will adjourn this evening and reconvene tomorrow at 8:30. Thank you.